missiles and tanks, as well as the complete destruction of the Syrian naval forces. More importantly, the vast majority, if not all, of the scientific research centers and numerous fortifications and strategic facilities that had been developed over decades were targeted and obliterated. The decline of Syrian military capacity is not a temporary setback. It represents a continuous loss. Why is this significant? Because the Syrian military capabilities supported all resistance efforts in the region, particularly those of the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance. When we look at the war media videos from the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, specifically Hezbollah, during the Al-Aqsa storm operation, we can see that the resistance fighters were using missile launch and control devices with instructions written in Arabic. Those with an interest in military affairs might find this scene quite unusual, as most weapons used in global conflicts, including those in our region, are typically imported from non-Arab sources. However, the weapons employed by the resistance to support Gaza and target enemy soldiers and tanks at the border were primarily, though not exclusively, of Syrian origin. Even the long-range missiles used by the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance to strike Haifa and Tel Aviv were mostly models developed in Syrian laboratories. For this reason, the decline of Syria's military capabilities, especially among its scientists and research centers, poses a setback for the entire resistance project in the region. This setback must be acknowledged, not only to recognize the merit of each individual or to mourn the loss alone, but also to recognize that there is a great opportunity to integrate Arab minds into the resistance development project, and for the Syrian experience to continue to serve as a model for future endeavors. The third type of loss resulting from the Israeli invasion of Syria is the loss of consciousness, which could be the most devastating in the fight against the enemy. The ongoing invasion, with no announcement from the enemy regarding its end or any specific timelines or objectives, has been met with a concerning silence from the new leaders in Damascus. In media circles, elite groups, and even among some popular supporters of the new government, a wave of deeply troubling reactions has emerged, causing concern for every Arab who understands the implications of an Israeli invasion of Syria. Officially, Abu Muhammad al-Jolani's regime has remained completely silent regarding the Israeli aggression. The occupation of rural areas in Daraa has drawn condemnation from countries like Egypt and movements such as Hamas in Palestine. However, the new Syrian regime has not voiced any objection. Supporters defended this silence as a way to avoid provoking Israel, preventing it from declaring war on the new Syria and hindering the establishment of a state there. This reasoning is the same one we see whenever the new regime makes political and security concessions to countries like the United States, Germany, Saudi Arabia, and other nations involved in the genocide agenda, in exchange for allowing it to strengthen its power. In essence, the regime offers concessions to these countries, and in return, they permit it to solidify its authority. However, this justification sets a political precedent that has a profoundly negative effect on the consciousness of both the Syrian and Arab people. What the new leaders in Damascus reveal through their silence is that they are unconcerned about the lives and futures of the Syrian people in areas currently occupied or at risk of future occupation. In simple terms, when the Syrian regime addresses its citizens, it essentially states, if the Israelis decide that your village, city, or farm is part of their security obsession, may God help you endure the occupation because we cannot confront Israel. May God help you endure the occupation because we cannot confront Israel. This abdication of responsibility is evident not only in their silence regarding the occupation, but also in the complete lack of discussion about it, except on rare occasions. They neither take a stand, nor do they acknowledge the history of the occupation. In other words, the leaders in Damascus are conveying to the Syrian people that the occupation of Syrian territory and the enemy's expansion there is not a concern at all. It's not an issue that needs to be on the agenda, or even if we were to view it as a problem, it certainly isn't a priority. This brings us to an unprecedented situation in the Arab world, where we are witnessing the occupation of vast and strategically important areas of Arab land with remarkable calmness. It seems we have reached a point where it has become normal for Israel to occupy any land in the region and dictate the fate of its inhabitants. Why do we say this situation is without precedent? Because there are so many arguments and justifications for remaining silent in the face of this invasion that they seem capable of erasing the last remnants of human logic. The primary and most significant argument is that we should remain silent in the face of the invasion to strengthen the foundations of the new regime we just mentioned. Throughout many revolutions, coups, and regime changes, external threats have often provided a chance for emerging ruling powers to validate their plans, establish their legitimacy, and showcase their ability to govern. For example, the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959 was quickly followed by an attempted U.S. invasion using local tools in the battle that became known as the Bay of Pigs. In this struggle, the Cuban Revolutionary Forces, led by Fidel Castro, did not retreat or shy away from confronting the United States and its allies, despite the significant disparity in capabilities between the two sides. Instead, they stood their ground and validated the legitimacy of their government through their fight. In a different context, following the success of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the outbreak of the war between Iran and Iraq, the new Iranian government did not state that its main priority was to stabilize the internal situation, which would have meant surrendering to Saddam Hussein. Instead, the war and the massive mobilization that occurred during this time served as a means to stabilize the new regime and created a reservoir of popular legitimacy that continues to exist today. Instead, the war and the massive mobilization that occurred during this time served as a means to stabilize the new government and created a reservoir of people legitimacy and created a reservoir of popular legitimacy that continues to exist today. In summary, when a community affected by external aggression sees that the ruling power is ready to defend them and protect their territory, status, and interests, they no longer need to make an effort to show loyalty to the new regime. This straightforward observation makes it clear that the rationale for consolidating power, even from a practical standpoint, is weak and lacks coherence in everyday language. The second reason for remaining silent in the face of invasion, which is widely circulated among the grassroots supporters of the new government, is the priority of the weapon or which direction we should first aim our guns. During the Israeli invasion of Syrian territory, the armed forces of the new Damascus regime engaged in numerous battles, some of which were quite challenging. But the key question is, where did these battles take place? The fighting occurred along the Syrian-Lebanese border, in the coastal region of Syria, and against the Kurdish groups in the east. In the clashes with Lebanese tribes in the Arontes Basin, an area within Syrian territory that has been home to Lebanese families for over a century, Shaheen drones, projectiles, and large quantities of bullets and ammunition were utilized. In essence, the real issue isn't a lack of weapons or fighters, but rather the locations where these weapons are being used and the orientation of the combatants. The prevailing sentiment among the factions governing Damascus today is that the primary focus of their struggle should be against the forces of the resistance axis, particularly Hezbollah and Iran. This is not an accusation or slander, rather it reflects what Abu Muhammad al-Jolani has conveyed in various reassuring statements to the West, emphasizing that Syria would not serve as a launchpad for attacks against any parties, including Israel. Furthermore, al-Jolani has indicated that the real threats to Israel from Syria and Hezbollah, Iran and Bashar al-Assad, whom he believes he has defeated in the heart of Syria. In several interviews, al-Jolani discussed the Israeli invasion of Syrian territory, stating that there is no longer any justification for Israel's actions in Syria. He argued that Israel's main goal was to confront Hezbollah and Iran. However, after gaining power in Syria, al-Jolani shifted his perspective, claiming that Israel has no ambitions in Syria and did not pose a threat to the country. He suggested that there was no animosity between Syria and Israel, attributing the conflict instead to the rivalry between Hezbollah and Iran on one side and Israel on the other. This is the same Israel that occupies part of Syria, specifically the Golan Heights, which it considers its own territory and has received U.S. approval to annex, falsely referring to it as part of Israel. Al Jolani's statement should not be viewed as insignificant. Rather, it represents a dangerous political stance that could influence the future of Syria and the entire region if not addressed appropriately. We return to what we mistakenly referred to as the margin of our earlier discussion, the notion of curbing hostility from supporters of the new Syrian regime towards Iran and Hezbollah. Previously, the rationale for this position was based on the claim that Hezbollah and Iran were meddling in Syria's internal affairs, regardless of the validity of that assertion. Now that Iran and Hezbollah have withdrawn from Syria, why does hostility towards them continue to be reprimanded? Why does hostility towards them continue to be a priority for some segments of the public and among Syrian officials? Additionally, why is this animosity not directed at Russia, despite accusations that its fighter jets have protected the regime and committed atrocities against Syrian civilians? This raises a clear rationale for the ongoing hostility that doesn't align with the previous claims. If those claims were accurate, there would be a direct declaration of enmity toward Russia. Instead, the Syrians are reaching agreements with the Russians and have allowed them to maintain their airbase in the coastal region of Syria. This stance or behavior indicates a misalignment in the direction of the groups currently in power in Syria. It's important to note that these groups do not represent the majority of Syrians, even if they claim to speak on their behalf indefinitely. The confusion among these groups dates back to 2011 and stems from various factors. Most concerning is that it places Israel in a position of either an ally or an overlooked enemy. In both scenarios, the animosity towards Israel diminishes within the hearts of the people, which in turn weakens their understanding of the core of the Zionist project and the necessity for a proper response to confront the annihilation agenda. In return, hostility towards the countries and nations' constituents prevails at the expense of hostility toward Israel. As a result, the gun of the new rulers in Damascus echoes in all directions and aligns with the Merkava. The defeat of awareness may be one of the toughest aspects of the losses we are experiencing due to the Israeli invasion of Syria. Resisting this invasion requires several conditions, the foremost being the recognition that Israel is the primary and most significant enemy, and that standing up to Israel is the only path to achieving dignity, freedom, strength, and political legitimacy. The Syrian people, much like the Palestinian, Lebanese, and Egyptian communities, have a wealth of experience in resisting Israel. As we mentioned earlier, Syria, both as a nation and a people, serves as a cornerstone of the Arab and Islamic resistance movement. However, relying solely on history and past experiences, along with established beliefs about the Syrian people's hostility towards Israel, is not enough in today's context. Today, the responsibility lies with everyone. Even if one lacks the means to arm themselves and join the fight, there is nothing stopping them from voicing their opinions. The least that the new Syrian regime can do is to acknowledge its inability to engage in combat. At the very least, it could clearly reject the occupation and Israel's actions in Syria. We are free to express our views. The most important thing is to reignite the spirit of resistance in Syria, enhancing the awareness of the resistance and correcting the course that Syria helped to set, in which it played a vital role. We also need to connect with all those in the region and around the world who prioritize opposition to Israel, seeing it as a path to salvation and true freedom for Syria, and ultimately for all our nations.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. His
on the football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of Hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble Imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, we have been talking about discontent and dissatisfaction in teens when it comes to appearance. So, Brother Liaqat, you told us in the previous episode some of the strategies how teens can be helping themselves. First of all, the problem lies in the social media world because they are so much comparing themselves and what social media has actually presented body image to them. They are they feel like this is something, this is perfection, and they need validation from every second person. So, like, how do we go ahead with these teens? You said some of the strategies, and I would want you to continue.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So I would start with a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, where he says, "Al jamalu fil lisan wal kamalu fil aql." The Imam says, beauty is found in the language, while perfection resides in the intellect.
Right.
So according to Imam Ali alayhi salam, this is something beautiful. Like, beauty is in one's tongue, or is in one's
speech.
Language, is in one's speech.
Yeah.
You see? You know, even there are social influencers who have good speech.
Right.
Like, who kind of
speak good.
When they speak, they are speakers.
Motivators.
Who are really good motivators, right. Yeah. Like, maybe they don't care too much about how they look.
Yeah.
Or what skin tone they have.
Right.
Or they're not going to change their skin tone, or maybe, like, their eye color or whatever, yeah. What they concentrate. And, of course, it's amazing to listen to them, yeah. Example, there are a few, example, scholars as well, who, when they speak, it's like, it's, oh, wow, this is such a nice speech. Oh, mashallah, such a nice, insightful thing.
Right.
Example, if we see about Ayatullah Behjat itself, like, there are thousands and thousands and maybe like millions of people or hundreds of thousands of Shias inclined towards this noble personality. They are maraje, okay? They didn't go through any kind of appearance,
right.
Surgeries and
yeah.
Stuff. But we see Shias inclined towards them.
Yes.
Example, they are... and of course, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also places a lot of nur or light in them, like inside them.
Within them,
exactly. So, and of course, kamal or perfection is in the intellect, like how intellect a person is. So persons should definitely ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to grant him or her beauty in
right.
language. And of course, perfection in the intellect. And of course, I remember a story or an incident, I would say, of Hazrat Jaun alayhi salam on the day of Ashura, when he comes and seeks permission to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam,
to engage in the battle.
Yeah, exactly. And he, of course, at the end of the day, he was granted permission, and he goes and he gets martyred. And the Imam, this is one of those shuhada where the Imam comes and he keeps his face, his cheek on the cheek of the Shaheed.
And
Shaheed,
it's also important to note here, like, Imam gives him permission when he himself says, "You are not giving me permission, maybe because of my appearance."
Yeah.
He says to Imam, because Imam says to him that, no, it's because, like, you have been serving.
Exactly, because he was slave of Hazrat Abu Zar Ghaffari. Yeah. And because he was a slave, so right. The imam was a bit hesitant to give permission. But at the end of the day, after he's saying, is it because of my appearance? The imam was like, no, not at all. And if you want to give, if you want to go to the battlefield, bismillah, you can go. Like, he gives permission.
Yeah, and imam actually mentions that you have been serving family for a very, very long time. Because from Abu Zar, he moves to Imam Ali. From Imam Ali to... like now Imam Hussain al-Islam, so he has been serving them for a very, very long time. So yes. Imam Hussain al-Islam actually feels like he's already served a lot.
Yes.
He's already done a lot for us. And now it's like, now he wants to sacrifice his life as well. This is like too much.
Yeah.
But then John again, he says like, is it because of my appearance?
Indeed, it's so, so, so beautiful that like the Imam, regardless of what his color is, even like he keeps his... a cheek on the cheek of Hazrat John, alayhi
salam. Yeah. We'll discuss more about this brave personality after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, Wa Khaliquna, Wa Rasiquna, Wa Huwa Ala Kulli Shay'in Qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about one of the famous personalities of Ashura, that is Hazrat John. And he was dark in color. He was a slave, and he was actually from the African continent. And then he happens to be one of the martyrs in Karbala.
Yep.
And Imam puts his cheek on his cheek, like he put his cheek on the cheek of Ali Akbar alayhi salam.
Yes, exactly. So even when Imam Sajjad alayhi salam comes to bury the bodies of the martyrs, he sees that there's a light which is shining bright from the body of Hazrat John alayhi salam
towards
and
the skies.
It's going towards the skies, and it is indeed like of course the du'as of Imam Hussein alayhi salam as well. And you know, if appearance is very important, then why would Imam keep his cheek on the cheek of John alayhi salam? So it's not appearance which is important. Just like he has kept his cheek on the cheek of his son Ali Akbar alayhi salam.
Yes.
So it's something else. It's not the surah, it's the seerah. It's not the appearance, it's the quality of the person which brought the imam like towards him, towards the person, and to such an extent like John was lying on the ground.
Right.
And imam went towards the ground in order to lay his cheek upon the cheek of Hazrat John, which is something. It is really something. So you know, even amongst the families of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we see the wife of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam being a Nigerian.
Okay.
The mother of Imam Jawad alayhi salam, the mother of the ninth Imam, was from the African continent. Yeah, and her skin tone was dark in color. So, which is the reason Imam Jawad alayhi salam was not white like his father.
Right.
Imam Rida alayhi salam was fair. He was proper Arab, and Imam Jawad alayhi salam had curly hair, like you know, like even the Africans, a few Africans have curly hair and stuff. And his color was not too white. He was not too dark. He was like the kind of moderate brownish, wheatish color kind of thing. So. And that is okay. That is not a problem. He's the imam. He is of the
quality to be imam, right?
And this lady, who is like, of course, the wife of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam, this noble lady got the opportunity to become the mother of an imam.
Right.
So it's actually the quality which brought her to this stage, you see? So indeed, it's not the appearance. So I would say the teen shouldn't go after these kind of very hollow structured people.
Yes.
They should definitely choose those people as role models who have a lot of power in them,
right.
positive vibes in them,
right.
who'll have a lot of things to learn from them in
right.
doing it.
Let's take a short break and continue the topic after a short break.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here with us in the studio, and we're discussing about dissatisfaction and discontentment. So you said, number one, our teens have to distance themselves from the social media thing.
Yes.
They have to take a break. Number two, they have to actually surround themselves with the good people
mm-hmm.
who are satisfied with themselves. Actually, this was the third point, the number two point that you said.
Focus on self-acceptance.
Yes, accept who you are, what you are, how you are, acknowledge yourself. And number three was same, the support, you know, surrounding yourself with the good people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said us about introducing some of the role models, which tell us the stories that to be focusing on Sirah, not the Surah.
Exactly.
To be focusing
and
on
also
the... Yeah, something beyond appearance.
Yes, exactly. Like self-worth beyond
yes.
Beyond appearance
right.
is very important. Like my worth is not my appearance, right? That's what is very important. Like, you know, for those teens, still, there are few people. They might be few people who still are behind appearance.
Yeah.
You can get few teens, okay? Even after like minusing a lot of quantity amongst them, okay.
Still they have so
there are people
obsessed
like
with self
who are yeah exactly who want to look really good. I would say them look for those who really want to look good, but they can't look good for any reason, like because they can't go through a lot of surgeries, because it's painful, because it's heavily budgeted, yeah, costly, and many other reasons, of course. Like maybe the parents are not going to support, whatever reason. I would say, look, the thing is, the appearance of the hereafter differs from the appearance of this world. So, if example, a person is looking like not too fair, not too black, example, is medium skin tone, and the eye color is just like any other eye color, any like it's black in color, hair is black in color, example, okay? But imagine if a person follows the steps of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, just like Joan, whose body was shining bright, okay? Because it was not his materialistic body. It's actually the heavenly body, which was having a lot of power, which was overpowering the materialistic body. You know, we have a riwayah, we have a narration where a person, a Shia, is going to see his hujja of the time in his real appearance.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the time of Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, a person makes a wish or kind of last will to the Imam that when he is going to die, the Imam should come to meet him.
All
so
right.
when this person was on his deathbed, he sees the Prophet coming. So he says, "Assalamu alaykum, Ya Rasulullah." He sees
right.
the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the second,
so on.
The third, fourth, and you know, Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam was there, present, like in his bodily form,
right.
the hujjah, the proof of Allah on earth. And he says salam to Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, "Peace be upon you, O the son of the Prophet, O Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, as I see you in your original form, in your enlightened form."
All right.
So the Imam is in it. So other people are seeing the Imam in a bodily form.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, he's in a humanistic form. But he is like the Imam is shining bright.
Right.
You see? So if we kind of develop a quality in such a manner that our soul is enlightened, then we will see who we really are on
Allah
the day of judgment.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you
die.
Us the, which is called as Chashma Basira.
Yeah.
Give us eyes of Basira.
And the appearance is something
see
beautiful.
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah, see things through. So, dear teens, be content with yourself. Do not compare yourself with these, I would say, artificial people. be mature, act natural. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Brother Liaka. Thank you, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Their names are linked to the Turkish and Ghanaian embassies. They show a strong interest in technology and have a consistent concern for the empowerment of women. These are the personal details of an individual with 12 years of professional diplomatic experience at the Israeli Foreign Ministry. And for the first time, we are revealing parts of it. Her name is Shani Cooper Zubaydah. In 2023, right when people were taking to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest Benjamin Netanyahu's policies during the October 7th events and witnessing the violence and bloody response from their leaders, few could have imagined that the self-proclaimed champions of true democracy in the Middle East would greet their own citizens with fists and kicks from the police, brutally suppressing them under the hooves of horses. Finally, they were sent to the ominous and unknown prisons of the regime for dinner. It's not surprising that the fraudulent Zionist regime during these days, filled with atrocities and tons of bombs, fall upon the defenseless people of Palestine and Lebanon, and facing worldwide public backlash, has felt the need to resort to its security and intelligence apparatus to maintain its existence. It has taken actions against both domestic and international protesters who happen to be Jewish as well.
Hello, my name is Shani Cooper Zubaydah, and I'm the new Israeli ambassador to Ghana, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
Miss Shani Cooper, a two-faced woman often appearing in a seasoned diplomatic attire with numerous travels from West Asia to the Horn of Africa and sometimes Southern Eastern Europe, has captivated various politicians. She has been engaged in extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic activities in countries like Egypt, Ghana, Cyprus, Turkey, and several others over the years. She sometimes casts a glance at and continues her work within the occupied Palestinian territories. Shani Cooper, a child of a Jewish family residing in Brussels, Belgium, migrated to the occupied Palestinian territories with her family members years ago. She has several sisters and brothers, each holding governmental positions within the Israeli regime. She earned a bachelor's degree in political science in 2002 from Tel Aviv University, concurrently obtaining a degree in journalism from the Koret School of Journalism and Communications. Finally, she graduated with a master's degree in political science from the same university in 2006. From 2003 to 2021, she held various positions, including assistant professor at Tel Aviv University, assistant professor at the Open University of the Zionist Regime, chief editor of the Haaretz News section, spokesperson for the embassy of the regime in Egypt, and deputy ambassador to Turkey, Cyprus, and ultimately ambassador of the Zionist regime to Ghana. Her work was not simply about establishing good relations between governments, but also involved actions with a security priority. In these days, an internal conflict within the regime has escalated, and physical clashes between government officials occasionally appear on television. She has played a crucial role and has taken on the task of identifying anti-Zionist elements in various countries under her mission. Meanwhile, given the increasing opposition within the Jewish community to the Zionist movement, operations to eliminate and assassinate opponents have also increased, and any action is, so to speak, stifled at the outset. Some of these assassinations have been carried out with such mystery that it is no longer easily possible to prove them. Fabricated accidents, death due to poisoning or incurable diseases, and other methods are part of this type of physical elimination by the Mossad security system, which has almost become commonplace. It is common for many people in the Israeli regime society to have a double life. Each individual, alongside their normal life, must also be a member of a military which is more widespread or one of the security organizations. Miss Shani is no exception. Cooper married a person named Hayem Zabera in 2006. Hayem Zabera worked in the consular section of the Israeli embassy in Egypt and Cyprus. Wherever Cooper was active, Zabera worked in the consular section of that embassy and currently works for a law firm. Cooper and Zabera have two daughters, Tamar and Shajar, both born in Egypt during Cooper's assignments to the Egyptian embassy. In Cooper's work history, a section titled News Editor of Haaretz Newspaper appeared from October 2003 to March 2006. Despite Cooper's status as a media figure and active journalist, with presumably many articles published, only two political review articles by her are found on Haaretz's website. Cooper, due to her strong interest in world travel, participates in an around-the-world tour in 80 days, allowing her to closely observe many important countries. This experience greatly helped Cooper in being chosen for sensitive positions. The countries where Cooper had diplomatic activity had a strong history of relations with the Zionist regime, high economic and commercial potential, and a high degree of influence in taking security actions against other countries. Following her appointment as an envoy of the Zionist regime in Ghana, Shani Cooper, in her first step, organized an anti-terrorism training course on September 6, 2018. In this course, she trained approximately 25 commanders of Ghana's Special Forces units in a three-day anti-terrorism training program conducted by the Israeli occupation forces. Cooper has undertaken sustained and significant activities in Ghana in agriculture, health, education, youth development, technology, and startups during her tenure there. Cooper's time in Ghana coincided with the COVID-19 pandemic. During this period, she implemented online training programs focused on educating marginalized communities and other initiatives in areas like national security, resilience, and digitalization. She also supported and provided grants to the health sector and offered financial aid to entrepreneurs in agriculture and innovation. But were all Cooper's actions in Ghana and Africa aimed at promoting development in the region, or does the Israeli regime have other objectives? Investigations show that the Mossad Intelligence Service views most African countries as opportunities for carrying out terrorist activities in other countries. The establishment of military bases in countries like Botswana and Rwanda, as well as the movement of Mossad intelligence officers and their sources to Kenya, Tanzania, South Africa, and Ghana, supports this claim. In July 2021, through the diplomatic efforts of Cooper, the Zionist regime was admitted as an observer member of the African Union. Although this diplomatic victory remains a subject of contention among member states, these decisions, along with Morocco's and Sudan's decisions to normalize diplomatic relations with the Zionist regime, demonstrates the importance of Africa in the regime's foreign policy. Cooper's feminist approach is clearly evident in all her media interviews. She considers the Zionist regime's embassy in Ghana a women's embassy. In addition to the security officer, three other representatives of the regime who manage the embassy are women. Following the completion of her assignment in Ghana in October 2021, Shani Cooper returned to the occupied territories and continued her work in the management division of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. No information regarding Cooper's activities and serious employment status in the media has been released since the end of Cooper's embassy mission in Ghana, and no information about her is available online from that date onwards. A review of Cooper's professional and diplomatic activities from 2003 to 2021, particularly her action during her tenure as ambassador to Ghana, suggests that Cooper cannot be simply described as an ambassador. The information obtained suggests that she is an Israeli intelligence officer who has appeared in various countries under diplomatic cover.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer told to be as robust as Canada with the US President as the UK stages last-ditch talks to strike a trade deal. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay with us. Guardian Daily writes, amid heightened fears that the US president could trigger a global trade war with devastating effects on the UK economy, Senior UK and EU diplomats said on Saturday night, on March 29th, Keir Starmer should fight back strongly against Donald Trump if he imposes punitive tariffs on British exports. British government officials in London and Washington are working frantically these days to try to persuade Trump not to slap duties on more key UK industries on what he is calling Liberation Day on Wednesday, April 2nd. The US president has already announced plans for 25% levies on imports of cars, steel, and aluminum to the US. One vital battleground now is over Washington's threat to impose blanket reciprocal 25% tariffs on all countries that impose value-added tax on U.S. exports. These countries include the U.K. and EU nations. The United States does not impose VAT on its imports. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, warned recently that the 20% increase in tariffs between the United States and the rest of the world would cut UK growth by 1% and entirely eliminate £9.9 billion of fiscal headroom that the Chancellor of Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, restored in the public finances by a painful program of welfare and other cuts in her spring statement recently. Starmer appears to be waiting to judge how to react based on the level of any tariffs imposed on the UK. He is said by government officials to be ready to act in the national interest if Trump does hit the UK hard. But his team also says that he will be pragmatic if need to, suggesting he may not retaliate immediately in the hope of talking Trump around over time and with the aim of creating the conditions for signing a wider UK-US trade deal. Diplomats now say Starmer, who has refused to issue a word of criticism of Trump since his return to the White House, must be prepared to retaliate or run the risk that the US president simply deploys the same tactic again and again, knowing his opponent will not fight back. Speaking to The Observer, the former UK ambassador to Washington, Kim Darroch, said Starmer should learn from the experience over recent days of the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, who appears to have softened Trump's tariff threat by warning of a strong Canadian retaliation and making clear his displeasure at the US president over his threats towards his country's sovereignty, an approach that has lifted his Liberal Party sustainability in the polls. Carney said it is clear that the United States is no longer a reliable partner. Lord Darroch said it's understandable that, faced with deeply damaging U.S. tariffs on British cars, steel and aluminum, the government should think about concessions like reducing digital tax. But they need to be wary of giving Trump wins. Tariffs are his all-purpose forcing mechanism, and he will use them again and again if he sees them working. And they should note the dramatic turnaround in Canadian politics, where on the back of a robust and defiant response to U.S. tariff threats, Mark Carney's Liberals have gone from 14 points behind the Canadian Conservative Party at the end of January to 8 points ahead last week. It is expected that Trump may impose less punitive tariffs on the UK than on member states of the EU, which he believes have taken an anti-US approach on trade over decades. João Valdo Almeida, former EU ambassador to the US and the UK, said he did not expect the UK to retaliate in the way the EU was bound to, but he said it was important that Starmer hit back in some way by criticizing the way the US president used tariffs as a tool of policy. Waldo Almeida said he, Starmer, should at least condemn the tariffs as they are bad for everyone. In her spring statement recently, Reeves, who is set to oppose retaliating to U.S. tariffs, said the global economy had become more uncertain, but at no point mentioned that it was Trump who had fueled the uncertainty and created the conditions in which a global trade war is now entirely possible. Carney, by contrast, has taken on Trump, telling him on Wednesday, March 26, that Canada would retaliate against the United States with tariffs of its own, potentially escalating a damaging trade conflict between the neighboring countries. An opinion poll for The Observer shows that after the spring statement, just 11% of UK voters expect the economy to improve over the next 12 months, with 23% saying it will stay the same and 61% that it will get worse. About 17% said they expected their finances to get better, 38% that they would stay the same, and 41% that they would get worse. Voters in this country rate with UK economy relatively poorly compared with large economic nations, particularly China. The UK economy is rated better than China's by just 9% of UK voters, with 10% saying it is about the same and 43% saying it is worse. Only 15% say the UK economy is better than that of the United States, with 16% saying it is about the same and 36% saying it is worse. Meanwhile, The Independent reports Keir Starmer has been warned against appeasing Donald Trump as he considers reducing a major tax for U.S. tech companies while cutting disability benefits and public sector jobs. His chancellor, Rachel Reeves, confirmed on Sunday, March 23rd, that there were ongoing discussions about the UK's £1 billion a year digital services tax that affects companies including Meta and Amazon. She expressed optimism that Trump's 25% tariffs on British steel could be removed in any deal, but did not deny there could be changes to the digital services tax, which the United States has lobbied against. She said, "You've got to get the balance right." While any changes didn't take place in her recent spring statement, the Liberal Democrats warned Labour was in danger of losing its moral compass, and it would be tantamount to robbing disabled people to appease Elon Musk and Trump. Labour MPs are already on the brink of rebellion over £5 billion of welfare cuts to disability benefits, and trade unions are concerned about £2 billion of Whitehall cuts, leading to about 1,000 civil service job losses, plus the risk of redundancies in arm's length bodies and local governments. The Labour MP and former Shadow Cabinet Minister Rachel Maskell said, with the Chancellor saying that she's still looking at the digital services tax, then I would be concerned if relief was granted in what would be seen as a dash to let the United States tech companies off the hook, while at the same time as making disabled people pay for their revenue loss, with their lifelines being cut. She said, "I recognize that the Chancellor has to rebuild the economy, but who pays for these matters, and it must never be the poorest in our society, which will be the outcome should the Department for Work and Pensions proposals go through." Clive Lewis, the Labour MP and another former Shadow Cabinet Minister, said, "This was entirely predictable given how desperate the government is to appease the Trump administration and tech oligarchs around it," adding, "This is extractive politics at its worst, and exactly the kind of deal the MAGA Make America Great Again movement wants. Rather than move closer to Europe and stand together, we are allowing ourselves to be ripped off." He said, "It was an object surrender even before the government chooses tax cuts for big U.S. tech and austerity for the most vulnerable, adding, frankly, it's unacceptable.
These children are victims of a war that ended over a half a century ago. Landmines and explosive remnants of war are the cursed inheritance left to them by war. Up until the 20th century, the number of killed and injured caused by munitions left from wars was quite inconsequential. But the weaponry bill during the First World War mandated a new definition of unexploded munitions, left over from wars. Access to more powerful weapons led to a greater number of deaths, and thus more victories in battle. But no one was thinking of the other consequences of using such weapons. The predicament of the munitions left over from that war hadn't made itself fully evident yet when the Second World War broke out with even more powerful and destructive weapons than those used in the first. We witnessed destructive weaponry reach its peak near the end of the Second World War. The atomic bombs the United States dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Second World War not only saw the use of deadly weaponry, but also millions of anti-tank and anti-personnel mines being buried into the ground by all the warring parties. The destructive effects of this kind of weapon only became clear after the war was over. The world was no longer safe for civilians. Landmines and explosive remnants of war started causing casualties, cities, villages, the countryside. Any place where a bullet was once fired was potentially contaminated. The U.S. Army opened a new chapter in its fanatical use of deadly weapons during the Vietnam War. They dropped millions of bombs from the skies and desecrated the land by burying millions of mines. Unexploded submunitions from cluster bombs used in this war were too many to count and are still found today in the countries dragged into the Vietnam War, some even in the proximity of schools where children are studying. The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, estimates that up to 11,000 people have been killed or maimed by unexploded ordnances, 30% of whom have unfortunately been children.